Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to episode 57 of Dogcast Radio. In this show, we talk to Deborah Howard, founder and president of the Companion Animal Protection Society.
These are animals in commercial facilities. They are being raised like livestock. So I guess the point being, would you want your family dog to be living in conditions like this, living in confinement all its days, being bred at every single heat, churning out puppies, not getting a chance to play and run and have exercise and have socialization? I mean, that's the life of a breeding dog, and that's what's behind that puppy in the window.
That's an interview I'm sure will inspire many of you to action. We also have an installment of Bernard Cartwright's Knock Nobbler.
Upon returning the stray, which spiralled with delight when released from Pix's cage, Pix's my dog van, by the way. I call it Pix because I pick dogs up.
And I'll be telling you about one or two interesting dog-related items that have caught my attention. But first, we have an interview with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who is an innovative biologist with some fascinating theories. Dr. Sheldrake studied natural sciences at Cambridge University, where he gained a double first-class honours degree and was awarded the University Botany Prize. Also at Cambridge, he took a PhD in biochemistry. He's written 75 scientific papers and 10 books. He wrote about the controversial subject of whether animals have psychic abilities in his book Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. In an earlier Dogcast episode, I interviewed Alex Sicaris, who is currently investigating the phenomenon. But I wanted to know from Rupert just how much research has already been done into this area.
Well, there's been quite a bit of research on dogs that know when their owners are coming home. Most of it done by me and by my assistant and associate, Pam Smart. Mm-hmm. I started off in the late 80s looking into this because I'd heard so many stories about pets knowing when their owners were coming home. The first thing, I just asked people to tell their stories, and I built up a collection of over 800 case histories of people telling stories about their dogs knowing when they're coming home. That was to see the natural history of it, you know, what had people noticed, under what conditions. In some cases, it's every day coming home from work. In other cases, it's, you know, when they've been away on a trip or coming home from holiday. In some cases, it's people who keep boarding kennels who've noticed dogs getting ready, you know, for their owners to return. Mm. And the most impressive cases are when the owners have come back unexpectedly early and the owners of the kennels weren't expecting them to come, but the dogs somehow knew. And then we did surveys to find out how common it was. We did them in Britain and America and found about 50% of dogs show anticipatory behavior. They go and wait at a door or window when their owner or the person they're most attached to is on the way home. So this shows that it's very common. A lot of dog owners have had these experiences. And we also look to see whether can it be explained just as a routine thing? Is it a kind of body clock? And the answer is, in a lot of households, people have non-routine lives, the dogs still know. Is it just familiar cars? No, because it happens if people come by public transport or bus or bicycle or taxi, mm-hmm. or are dropped off by friends. Is it the dog picking it up from the people at home? Well, no, in many households, the person at home doesn't know when the absent person is coming, so sometimes there's no one at home. So that was the first phase of the research, looking at what people have noticed with their dogs, and starting from there. The second phase was setting up controlled experiments. And how those worked was that I did these first with Pam Smart and her terrier, JT. Mm. How we did the experiments is that we filmed the place the dog waited in her parents' flat. She lives next door to her parents, and she left the dog with them in their flat when she was out. And the dog always waited at a French window where he could see her arrive in her car. So we filmed the place the dog waited. She then went out at least 5 miles away, And in these experiments, she didn't know when she was coming home when she went out. She didn't know until we sent a message on a telephone pager at a randomly chosen time. Then she went home, and in many of our experiments, she travelled by taxi to avoid any familiar car sounds, a different taxi each time. And what we found was that over and over again, the dog went and started waiting at the door or window when she made the decision to come home, before she even got into the taxi or the car she was travelling in. We also found it worked when she travelled on public transport, by bicycle, by train, and came in friends' cars. So that was a long series of experiments, more than 100 videotaped experiments with JT. And then we did a series of other experiments with another dog, a Rhodesian Ridgeback called Kane, with very much the same results. And these, the data, the analysis, everything's published in scientific journals, and anyone can read about it on my website, which is www.sheldrake.org.
Mm-hmm.
So this research showed that dogs really do seem to know when their owners are coming home, or at least some dogs. It can't be explained in terms of routine, of familiar sounds of cars, of smells, because the furthest a dog can smell a person is half a mile. We talked to the police bloodhound training unit in Essex, where they've done, it's the only people we could find who've done research on just how far away a dog can smell somebody when they're directly upwind and the wind's blowing in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's about half a mile with a bloodhound, and they're the most sensitive.
Yes.
So it's not happening by smell. It's not car sounds. It's not routine. It's not the dog picking up clues from people at home. And all that leaves is the dog picking up the person's intention to come home, which looks like a kind of telepathy.
Yes, yeah. You've said that I think it was about 50% of dogs seem to display this behaviour.
Yes.
Do you think it could be? Is it that some dogs have this ability, some dogs don't? Or could it be it's the particular match of the dog and person? You know, the dog can only connect to you, you know, if you're the right person, sort of thing.
Well, we don't know. I mean, of course, we're interested in, you know, what is it that makes some dogs do it and others not.
Mm.
It's nothing to do with the breed. We found that dogs of all breeds and kinds do this. So it wasn't as if it was just terriers that did it or just poodles. I mean, all kinds of dogs, gun dogs, working dogs, and so on. They're all categories of dog do it.
Mm.
It does seem to depend on a close bond between the dog and the owner. About 70% of dogs only do it for one person.
Mm-hmm.
The most of the rest, about 25%, will do it for two people, if they're bonded to two people strongly. And the remainder, a few, do it just for, they do it for three people. But nearly always, it's just one person they do it for.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem to depend on a close bond. Now, it's possible, of course, that some people have close bonds and the dogs don't react. You know, dogs vary just as people do. And there are people who've kept dogs who say one dog does it, another dog doesn't, you know. So it's just as people differ in their sensitivity and motivation, so dogs do. So I haven't come up with any simple explanation of why some do it and why some don't.
Yeah, yeah. That was one of the things I was going to ask, you know, is it related to breed? Is it related to, you know, could it be gender or the age of the dog, you know, anything, any patterns like that?
Well, we looked at that too, and we didn't find any dogs doing this less than a year old.
Mm.
And so it may be they take time to build up the bond, or it may be people just didn't notice it, you know, when they were quite young. Takes people a while to cotton on to what's happening unless they're looking for it. And I don't know, we didn't seem to find any upper limit. I mean, JT, who we did most of the research with, is now dead. And he, when he got sort of quite old, he didn't do it as much. You know, I think older dogs, you know, they're just old. They're not as energetic or can't be bothered as much. So it does seem to fade out with age. But most dogs will do it, you know, until they're very old. And from the time they're about a year. And I should emphasize, they don't all do it equally. Some dogs, like JT, do this, he used to do this, you know, almost every time when Pam was coming home. And he did it when she set off to come home. There's some dogs that only do it a few minutes in advance. And so there's some that only do it occasionally. But certainly some dogs do it very reliably, and they do it, you know, quite a long time in advance. If the person sets off from a long way away and takes an hour to come home, the dog will be waiting for an hour. So there's certainly a lot of variation between dogs, but it is quite a common phenomenon, and I'm sure that most people who've kept dogs or know people who keep dogs will find somebody who's noticed this. Every town and village around the world is likely to have people who've seen this for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. I think the most intriguing part is that the change in the dog's behaviour occurs at the point that the owner or the person the dog is bonded to decides that they're coming home. There's obviously, you know, some link. You know, as you say, they're not detecting anything else. It's actually the decision in that person's mind. That's amazing.
Well, it is. It is. It's to do with the person's mind. I mean, that is what seems to be happening. And it is amazing in a way because it does show that dogs can pick up people's intentions.
Mm.
And, of course, a lot of dog owners have noticed this anyway. A lot of dog owners have told me, you know, the dog seems able to read my mind. Of course, if the person's in the same room, then you could argue that the dog's picking up subtle body cues, you know, emotional changes, possibly even changes in smell as the owner changes their mood or intention. But when they're miles away, that's simply not a plausible explanation. And that's why I concentrated on these experiments with dogs knowing when their owners are coming home, because you can rule out normal clues like body language, smell, tone of voice, etc., because they're simply so far away the dog couldn't possibly detect all these by means of the normal senses.
I believe you use the terms morphic field, and is it morphic resonance?
Yes, I do. I've got a theory about how social animals are connected together. I think members of social groups are linked together through what I call a morphic field. Morphic comes from a word morphe in Greek that means form or shape or structure. They're basically organizing fields. And I think that all social animals have them. A bee's hive, an ant's nest, a termite colony, a flock of birds, a school of fish. The individuals are coordinated in the way they behave in relation to each other, and I think they're responding to a kind of group mind or group field, the morphic field of the group. Now, I think when a dog becomes bonded to a person, dogs are, of course, descended from wolves, which are very social animals. They form strong bonds, social bonds, emotional bonds, and they're linked through a morphic field with their owner. When the owner goes away, the morphic field doesn't break. It's not as if either of them ceases to have a relationship with the other just because they're out of earshot or can't see each other. They remain linked at a distance through this bond, which I think works through the morphic field. A change in one can affect the other. And I think it's this field that connects them that is the basis for telepathy. So I think telepathy is a perfectly normal, natural way in which animals stay in touch with each other in the wild, and when they form bonds with us, they stay in touch with us at a distance. I think this is not spooky or weird or anything. I just think it's a normal way that animals are linked to each other, and when they're domesticated, linked to us.
And what does morphic resonance mean?
Morphic resonance is a kind of memory process where something's happened before. Anything similar that's happened before will influence something now. In its most general form, it says that species have a kind of collective memory. Each member of the species draws on a collective memory and contributes to it. And in animals, this underlies their instincts, which I think are from a kind of collective memory. The same is true of dogs. And where it comes into the bond with the owner is that the bond takes time to build up. When the owner you first get a dog, you're not instantly bonded. It's through interacting over weeks and months that the bond is built up through the memory of all those interactions. The bond has a kind of memory in it, and the morphic resonance is what gives the bond this memory. So that's where morphic resonance comes in. Mm-hmm. And this is just my own theory as to how this happens, but there's very few other people who've got any theories at all, so it's probably the best one on the market at the moment. There may be better ones, but anyway, that's how I try to explain it. And the fact is, no one really understands these things very much, and I think we're just at the beginning of trying to understand some of these otherwise unexplained aspects of animal behaviour.
Yes, yeah. Are you still researching into it?
Well, I am, in the sense that I'm still interested in animal behaviour. I'm a biologist, and I still collect stories about this, and if I get opportunities to do experiments, I do. But I'm not, at the moment, doing more experiments on dogs knowing when their owners are coming home. I've done lots of them. Mm. I've published them in scientific journals. It's shown clear-cut results. And there's no point for me to go on doing it over and over again. Mm. But what Alex Sarkaris is trying to do through open source science is to see if other people can replicate this kind of phenomenon with dogs. You know, if other people can get the same effects that I did in my experiments. The point being that in science, if one person does something, that's interesting, but no one really believes it much until it's been independently replicated by others. So independent replication is part of the scientific game, and it's what you need to do. Well, obviously, by definition, I can't myself independently replicate my own experiment, because it wouldn't be independent if I was doing it myself. So what we really need is studies by other people with other dogs to see whether this, in fact, can be pinned down with the case of other dogs, too. And actually, there have been two or three further attempts to do this by people for television companies making films about that. And the most recent was a film about my work in 2006 called The Man with the Extended Mind. It's available in streaming video on the internet. And that shows an experiment with a dog that it's not terribly clear-cut, but I mean, the dog did seem to know when its owner was coming home. They ended it once. I mean, these experiments you really need to repeat. But there have been various other attempts to do this. But what Alex is trying to do is to encourage people in Britain and America and all around the world to do more studies of this kind, because, you know, it's really important. If this is true, it's really important that we recognise what's going on and that dogs really can be telepathic with their owners.
Because when I talked to Alex, he had some suggestions that people could test their own dogs at home, if you like, and sort of do this experiment with, you know, phoning back and saying, I'm coming back now, and does the dog, react to that? But is there any possibility, you know, if you do these tests and these assessments and your dog doesn't seem to display it, is there any way that you can help them develop it? You know, have you ever come across that?
I've never come across anyone who's consciously tried to train the dog to do this. I think that for ones who show a tendency to do it, you know, it's encouraging them, showing an interest in it would be one way of encouraging them, making them aware that they're being noticed and appreciated for giving this warning of when someone's coming home. And I think one thing, I mean, so there's no point anyone trying an experiment if the dog doesn't do it anyway. And in most households where the dogs do it, people have noticed it. But there are some people who live alone, for example, who can't notice it because they don't. The dog may always be at the door when they get home, but they don't know how long it's been there. So this is easier to do, this research, for people who don't live alone, you know, when there's somebody at home, to observe the dog. And what I always recommend to people if they want to take up this research is the first and simplest step is simply to keep a log of what happens. Have the person at home note down in a notebook, you know, when the dog starts waiting and what time the person gets home. And then the person who's coming home they also have a notebook and note down what time they decide to come home and when they set off and when they get home and how they travel. And that way, it's possible to see, you know, how reliable the dogs are, whether they do it every time or just sometimes, how long in advance they're giving a warning. So that kind of logbook is the first step, and that's terribly easy to do. All you need is a couple of notebooks, and it's very revealing and helpful and low-tech.
Mm.
The more formal experiments involve filming the place the dog waits using a camcorder or a video camera. And that, again, it's not very difficult. Lots of people have got cameras nowadays. And so we're not talking rocket science here. We're talking about something quite easy to do in an ordinary home.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking on your website, there's another phenomenon, or, you know, I can't think of the word, but we'll stick with phenomenon. This sense of being stared at. So can you tell us about that? Because that was quite intriguing, because, again, that's something that you can try with your dog at home, isn't it?
It certainly is, yes. There's lots of people have noticed that they can tell when they're being looked at. About 90% of the population have found that they've had the experience of, you know, turning around to find someone staring at them, or conversely, staring at someone who then turns around. It's a very common experience. And I've done research on that. We've done actual experiments, mostly with school children, university students in schools and colleges. And the results show that people really can tell when they're being looked at. They're not always right, but they're more right than you'd expect just by guessing, by chance.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that a lot of animals can tell when they're being stared at as well. And in fact, I think this is something that happens in wild animals as a kind of predator-prey thing, that if a prey animal can tell when the predator is staring at it, it would enable it to escape more effectively than if it couldn't notice that. So I think this is a very basic biological thing that's deeply embedded in animal nature, not just human beings at all. And when you think about the sense of being stared at, if it's something that protects prey animals from predators by giving them a warning when a predator is looking at them, the time they're most vulnerable is when they're asleep.
Mm.
All animals are most vulnerable when they're asleep because they're, you know, not paying attention to what's going on around. They're easy target for a predator. So you'd expect sleeping animals to be able to detect when they're being looked at. And that seems to be the case. A lot of people have noticed that they can wake up their dogs or cats by staring at them when they're asleep. It doesn't always work.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that many people have noticed, and that's something that anyone who's not noticed it could try out at home. In fact, my slogan for this line of research is, don't let sleeping dogs lie. Stare at them. This is something anyone can try at home, and you can actually do proper scientific experiments with this by, you know, filming the dog, staring at them at randomly chosen times and seeing if they respond to the stare. But so this is a phenomenon that's, it's a thing that anyone can make observations on when they're at home. And some people have found that the converse is true. Some people have told me that, you know, they can be asleep in the morning and then they wake up and they find their dog is staring at them soulfully. hasn't woken them up by jumping on the bed or whining or barking or anything. It just sits and stares at them, and they wake up to find the dog looking at them. So people seem to be woken up by the stares of dogs as well.
Mm. Do you think they wake up with the thought in their head, I must feed my dog?
I think it's quite likely, yeah.
I think so. I think that would be the thought. The dog was beaming to you, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's incredibly intriguing. I find it very interesting. And, I mean, I must admit, I've really enjoyed having a look at your website. Because there are many more experiments on your website, and there's other ways that people can, try this out for themselves, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I wrote a book about this, which is called Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, easy to remember title, which isn't just about dogs, and it's not just about coming home. It's the subtitle is And Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. Mm. And I deal with a whole range of other phenomena that people have noticed with dogs. Some people find their dogs can pick up telepathically when they're planning to take them for a walk, even if they're in a different room, even at an unexpected time. Some people's dogs know when they're planning to give them a treat and come rushing into the kitchen, even though no one's made a sound or given any clue.
Yeah.
There's a whole range of other phenomena that people have noticed. I have this huge database, thousands of case histories of unexplained dog behavior. And it's a kind of natural history of what lots of people have noticed. And so anyone who's interested in making observations on their own dog at home, my book gives quite a number of examples, and I also have an appendix to the book that explains how you can make your own observations. And I'm always happy to hear from people who've done experiments or made observations with their dogs, and people can contact me through my website. So it'd be great if anyone who's listening could actually take part in this research.
If you'd like to participate in Rupert's research or just have fun finding out more about your dog, visit his website via the link on the Dogcast Radio site, where we also have a link to Alex Securis's research. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com. At this time of year, many of us are sorting through photographs we took over the festive season, perhaps trying to store and categorise them in some way. Well, it may be that your dog could help you in this task, because a new study shows that dogs can classify colour photographs and transfer knowledge in computer tests. Like us, our canine friends are able to form abstract concepts. Frederick Range and colleagues from the University of Vienna in Austria have shown for the first time that dogs can classify complex colour photographs and place them into categories in the same way that humans do. And the dogs successfully demonstrate their learning through the use of computer-automated touchscreens, eliminating potential human influence. The study has just been published online in Animal Cognition, a Springer publication. In order to test whether dogs can visually categorise pictures and transfer their knowledge to new situations, four dogs were shown landscape and dog photographs and expected to make a selection on a computer touchscreen. In the training phase, the dogs were shown both the landscape and dog photographs simultaneously and were rewarded with a food pellet if they selected the dog picture. Positive stimulus. The dogs then took part in two tests. In the first test, the dogs were shown completely different dog and landscape pictures. They continued to reliably select the dog photographs, demonstrating that they could transfer their knowledge gained in the training phase to a new set of visual stimuli, even though they had never seen those particular pictures before. In the second test, the dogs were shown new dog pictures pasted onto the landscape pictures used in the training phase, facing them with contradictory information. On the one hand, a new positive stimulus, as the pictures contained dogs, even though they were new dogs. On the other hand, a familiar negative stimulus in the form of the landscape. When the dogs were faced with a choice between the new dog on the familiar landscape and a completely new landscape with no dog, they reliably selected the option with the dog. These results show that the dogs were able to form a concept, i.e. dog, although the experiment cannot tell us whether they recognised the dog pictures as actual dogs. The authors also draw some conclusions on the strength of their methodology. Using touchscreen computers with dogs opens up a whole world of possibilities on how to test the cognitive abilities of dogs by basically completely controlling any influence from the owner or experimenter. They add that the method can also be used to test a range of learning strategies and has the potential to allow researchers to compare the cognitive abilities of different species using a single method. So apparently, our dogs are even smarter than we think. Another piece of research that caught my attention was a piece entitled Walkies, How a Brisk Stroll Can Stave Off Midlife Depression in Women. Though I am not quite midlife yet, although some would say fast approaching it, which is sufficient to bring on depression, I read the article. It turns out that women who walk 5 times a week for 1.5 hours had the best mental health in a recent US study, with even a shorter walk of 40 minutes 5 times a week also having a beneficial effect. As we face a new year, many of us make resolutions about our health. But maybe one of the best ones is to make sure we do plenty of walking with our dog. There's no expensive joining fee, no need for fancy equipment. We'll be healthier and happier. And best of all, so will our dogs. Pharaoh hounds can blush. When they're excited or happy, their ears, nose and eyes become pink. The Companion Animal Protection Society, or CAPS, is America's only national non-profit organisation dedicated exclusively to protecting companion animals. Their foremost concern is the abuse and suffering of pet shop and puppy mill dogs. Deborah Howard founded CAPS in 1992, and I asked her what experiences led her to do this.
I walked into a pet shop in 1989, and I saw a dog there with a cut in its leg, a Labrador Retriever, and I kept pressing the cut against the wire grate of the cage. And I took the dog out. I was very concerned also by the conditions in the store, which were pretty dirty. Mm-hmm. And there were dogs there with bloody diarrhea. The cages were dirty. And then I decided to find out where they got their puppies, and then that was how I found out that most pet shop puppies come from puppy mills, which, by the way, in the UK are called puppy farms.
And so this was a huge problem in America.
It is a huge problem here, yes. We have, I don't believe you have pet shops there in the UK, do you?
Well, we have pet shops, but it's, I mean, I have to say, I have never personally seen a puppy in a pet shop. I mean, there are no...
You're just the pet supplies. So people go to breeders your country.
You can buy pets, but smaller pets. I've never seen a dog or cat in a pet shop. We don't.
Right.
Yeah. So there isn't that... I mean, there are puppy farms. And as you say, there are disreputable breeders. But we don't have that pet shop angle.
Yeah, that's it. But you do have puppy farms.
Oh,
and
yes.
That I know about. I'm kind of digressing here, but I was in, are you familiar with a publication called Dogs Today?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, well, I was in an article in Dogs Today a number of years ago. Actually, the author was somebody in Oregon in the United States. And I actually had correspondence from women who did rescue work in the UK, one in North London and one in Wales, and they started sending me articles about the puppy farms. Which I understand are primarily in Northern England and maybe Ireland.
Yeah.
But the problem here, yes, it's a lot more serious because we have a lot of pet shops in this country, and almost every single puppy you're going to see in a pet shop is coming from a puppy mill, and most of those are commercial breeding facilities, meaning that there's a whole system here. There's the United States Department of Agriculture regulating most of these facilities. So one has to have a federal license to raise dogs for resale to the pet shop industry.
Mm.
So if you have an A license, you're a breeder. If you have a B license, you're a broker. So what happens is actually the puppies are going from the breeder to the broker to the pet shop. Most pet shops do not buy directly from breeders. They buy from brokers. And some of the brokers also breed as well. So the puppies are picked up. I mean, they're brought to the brokerage facility, and then they're put in trucks, and they're transported, or they're taken to the airport, and they're flown. So they're also being transported. And then, of course, then they spend a lot of time in the pet shops as well. And we have pet shops all over the country, and it's also a very serious problem in Canada as well.
Mm.
When I went into this pet shop and I found out where the dogs came from, of course, I was very alarmed. I have a law degree. I was doing public relations at the time, and I thought the best way to address this issue was through publicity. And I contacted 2020, which is a news program in this country very well known, about doing a story. They had been thinking about doing a story. And I, at the same time, happened to meet a young man who worked in a Dr. Pet Center, which was the same store I had gone into, but a different location. At that time, Dr. Pet Centers was the big chain in this country with 300 stores. So he was actually an animal rights activist who had felt sorry for the dogs and decided to take a job there trying to help them. not even to investigate. I mean, he just merely wanted to help the dogs. And he saw some horrible things there. He'd come in, and puppies were dead. They were dying. They had parvovirus, which is a very contagious illness. So he went undercover for us for 2020 and shot video. They had a room in the back with a freezer where they keep the dead animals in boxes. And he went undercover for this story, and then I started to do other publicity. I met our board member, Robert Baker. At that time, he was an investigator for Humane Society of the United States, and he ultimately left them and came to work for us. But he and I kind of joined forces, and I went to Life magazine and People magazine. And meantime, I started organizing protests all over the United States and Canada for 4 years in about 30 to 40 cities. Mm. So against pet shops that bought dogs from puppy mills, so that's, you know, it's pretty much any pet shop. And the first year we targeted just the Dr. Pet Centers, and then the following 3 years we did any pet shops. But the Canadian groups are great. They're very, very organized. They have a very serious problem in Canada, too. And by the way, the Canadians are also getting dogs from American puppy mills.
Yeah.
They have puppy mills in Quebec and some of these other places, but a lot of the puppies there are coming from puppy mills in the United States.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the combination of the protests and the media, and pretty soon Dr. Pet Center went into bankruptcy. But now there's another really big chain called Petland, and they're in this country, and they're in Canada, and they're in Chile and Japan, and I can't remember where else, but they're a formidable, corporation.
Yeah, yeah. So the I hadn't realized this then. Is it true then that when people buy a dog in America, the most often they will go to a pet shop, not directly to a breeder?
I'm not sure exactly how many people actually go to pet shops versus go to a breeder, but I think it's people, when they don't do their homework, when they're not educated, go to a pet shop.
Yeah.
The typical pet shop customer in this country is a young adult.
Yeah.
We have an online complaint form. We get pet shop complaints all the time. For both the United States and Canada. And typically it's somebody, in their early 20s, probably isn't married yet, or maybe just got married, doesn't have children. They look at this as a child. Or it could be a family whose pet just died.
Mm.
So we find that. I mean, their dog just died, and they're vulnerable, and they literally see the puppy in the window.
Yeah.
And a lot of these pet shops have payment plans. Others like Petland have a whole marketing program. We've had investigators who have worked undercover at Petland. One of them worked undercover at Petland, and we have access to the training manuals and so forth. And they have a whole marketing strategy about how the salespeople are supposed to sell these puppies and market the puppies. Put the puppy in the person's arms. They have answers to all the questions. If a customer says, does it come from a puppy mill? They say, no, of course not. We buy from a USDA licensed facility. They're inspected by the government. It sounds really great. Just because it's inspected by the government, of course, doesn't mean anything, because the USDA is just not doing its job of inspecting these facilities, which is why my investigators go undercover to puppy mills all over the See, most of the puppy mills are in the Midwest, Midwestern states, and Pennsylvania. So we've probably investigated over 1,000 puppy mills, mostly USDA licensed, in probably the last 10 to 12 years.
Mm.
The other problem that's getting really serious is that there's a lot of internet breeders too now. So again, a lot of those complaints too. People are buying online.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess,
and some of those people aren't regulated at all.
Yeah, I guess that which is exactly what CAPS is doing. Is the key is educating people so they know,
right,
the criteria that you need to make sure you're buying a dog from the right source, isn't it?
Well. And we don't even advocate. I mean, I don't know about in the UK, but here we have a terrible overpopulation problem. And I know it's kind of different in Europe. I mean, I've actually been in a Petland in France, and they do have Petlands there. But I don't. There are so many animals in this country that are not wanted. Animals are so disposable here, and we just cannot justify people going to breeders, even if it's a reputable breeder, when there's, several million dogs and even more cats being put down every year at shelters because they don't have homes. And some of these are purebred animals.
Yeah.
So we are always telling people to go to a shelter, to go to through a rescue. We have a lot of purebred rescue organizations if you have to have a purebred. Now, I'm not a proponent of purebred animals either, but you know, I think mixed breed dogs are just fine.
Yeah.
But we have something here called Pet Finder, which is a wonderful website where, and there are other websites just like it, where you can type in your zip code and find all the rescue organizations and shelters. You can even search by breed. And it's a wonderful resource for people. So that's what we're advocating because, you know, there are probably at least 500,000 puppies coming out of puppy mills every year going to pet shops.
Mm-hmm.
And now even more going over the Internet. And people are buying puppies online. The puppies are being flown and they are arriving. And sometimes they're nearly dead or they die shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
And then you have no recourse.
No.
We have also laws in this country in some states that will protect consumers to a certain extent. They're called lemon laws. So, for example, if you bought a puppy and it got sick, and that's the big problem is a lot of these puppies get sick, and then you incur veterinary expenses, the law would help you recoup some of those expenses. For example, if you paid $1,000 for the dog, which is not uncommon, you would be able to recover $1,000 in veterinary expenses. But only certain states have those laws and some states don't, and so we're trying to change that as well. But, of course, that's just a Band-Aid approach that doesn't really address the issue, but it does help consumers who have to spend a lot on veterinary bills to make their animal healthy again. And then, of course, you have dogs that die, and then, you know, nothing's going to bring that dog back. People don't want to return their dog. I mean, that's the bottom line. Most people are not going to take a sick puppy back to a pet shop because they've become attached to the animal.
Yeah. I mean, one of the worst things there is, I mean, as you said, the situation here isn't as bad as in the States. But, I mean, when you do buy from a breeder, that breeder
right.
is inspecting you. And it's the same, you know, if you get a puppy, you know, or a dog from a shelter, that shelter is going to visit you. It's going to look at your house, look at your lifestyle,
right.
look at your family.
You know,
is this dog, is it the right fit for you? What they're not looking at is a fast buck, are they?
Right, exactly. A reputable breeder is going to not only offer you, most reputable breeders will tell you that you can bring the dog back. I mean, not to say you're going to get your money back, but at any time you don't want that dog, you can bring it back to that breeder.
Mm-hmm.
They're also going to have tested the parents for certain genetic disorders. And as you know, I mean, purebred dogs have a lot of genetic problems, and I've personally experienced this. I had a golden retriever that dropped dead at age 6 from a genetically enlarged heart. 13 months before that, I lost a Cocker Spaniel who had a liver called Cocker liver disease. He had almost no liver left. And then I had a dog from rescue, a golden retriever that I helped lose 50 pounds. But and he lived, you know, he lived till he was almost 11, but he had hemangiosarcoma, which is cancer of the blood vessel lining, and that, again, is also kind of genetically predisposed.
Mm.
So that's the other thing I tell people. I mean, you may like a certain purebred dog, but you're going to run that risk, and especially with a puppy mill dog, where they're going to be more inbred, of there being, you know, genetic problems being just a lot more prevalent.
Yeah.
Mixed breed dogs just tend to be a little bit sturdier. So we have this, you know, we have the federal government supposedly inspecting these facilities that raise dogs for the pet shop industry. And so not only are we educating the public, but we're also trying to bring about changes in our Congress. We're trying to get oversight hearings on the entire Department of Agriculture inspection program. And I go to Washington quite a bit. We have a large law firm that does pro bono lobbying for us. In the spring, and we're trying to get hearings. It's not easy. I've been 7 times already, and we haven't accomplished it, but that's our goal, is to really get attention focused on the federal government not doing their job in terms of inspecting these facilities. We go to the facilities. We document the violations. We shoot undercover footage. We write up all the violations that we see there. We have photographs. We take all of this to members of Congress. We meet with the Department of Agriculture. And then, of course, I do a lot of work with the media as well. So that's, you know, so we're also trying to affect changes in the legislature. And then, you know, of course, also the outreach to the public through education, through media exposure, and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you founded CUPS in 1992, didn't you?
Right.
Yeah. So, you, obviously, you, this is a fight you've been fighting a long time. But it sounds
I actually walked into that pet shop in 1989, at the end of 1989, so that was 18 years ago, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it does sound like there's still a long way to go before things are as you would want them to be, doesn't it?
It's very much an uphill battle because as long as people are going to go to a pet shop, you're going to keep the puppy mills in business.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, puppy mills are not illegal. In fact, they're licensed by the federal government, and some states also have inspection programs that usually aren't very good either. So it all depends. The other thing being that some of these dogs come with registrations, and that people think they're getting something wonderful because of that. But now, we used to have American Kennel Club, but now we have a whole bunch of other registrations that have cropped up in recent years. That are just for dogs that come from puppy mills.
Mm.
But people don't know that, and they think the dog comes through the registration. The dog must, be something special. It doesn't really add, even an AKC registration doesn't really guarantee the health, the quality, or the lineage of your dog.
No. I mean, it is horrendous, because we covered a story recently in our news where breeding facility had a license for 500 dogs. And they were actually, they had 1,000 dogs taken away from them. They actually had 1,000 dogs. But even so, 500, how can you possibly give 500 dogs a good quality of life? How can that be possible?
Is this in the UK?
In the States.
Oh, you're talking about in Virginia?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yes, I think
that's
to be
honest with you, there's a facility in Missouri that has 3,000 dogs.
Hmm. Good grief.
And we've been there. They're very suspicious. They don't let us, but they have golf carts. I mean, that's how they get around. It's so enormous. 1,000 dogs is not unusual. There are the largest broker in Minnesota, who's also a breeder, and the largest broker breeder in Iowa. They both have at least 1,000 dogs.
These are
places we've investigated. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. You tell me. You obviously have a better idea than I do, but is it possible that you can have that many dogs and, do it properly, give them the good standard life and breed properly? Or is that, because it doesn't sound like it to me, but is that possible?
Well, if you have enough employees, it's possible to keep it clean.
Mm.
We have been to a handful, and I say only a handful, of facilities that were completely in compliance with the Animal Welfare Act, which is the federal law that the United States Department of Agriculture enforce. And the Animal Welfare Act has a set of regulations, and those are the ones we have to cite when we find violations, when we go in there ourselves.
Yeah.
We have been to clean facilities, but this is what is different here is these are commercial breeding facilities. So these are animals that, although you may go to a facility that's completely spotless, these are animals in commercial facilities. They are being raised like livestock. So I guess the point being, would you want your family dog to be living in conditions like this, in confinement all its days, being bred at every single heat, churning out puppies, not getting a chance to play and run and have exercise and have socialization? I mean, that's the life of a breeding dog, and that's what's behind that puppy in the window. So you may think you feel sorry for that puppy at the pet shop, when you're buying that puppy, you're just perpetuating this entire breeding industry.
Yeah.
So really, it's interesting that this industry is regulated by the Department of Agriculture because they're considering dogs and some cats we've never actually seen a cat breeding facility, although we've seen some listed. We haven't actually had access to any cats, but primarily dogs. I mean, these are dogs that are considered livestock and are treated as such.
Oh.
And it can be a very clean, spotless facility, but it's going to be a very commercial-looking type of place, and it runs the gamut from that. But I mean, most of them are not clean, and some of them are even, are bordering on neglect and cruelty. And the other problem we really have in this country is that these places are in rural America, and a lot of people are friendly with their sheriff, with their prosecutor. Even we've had a case where he even knew the judge, a very horrific cruelty case, where he let the dog starve to death. There were skeletal remains. I mean, it's hard. We did a story with Dateline, which is another well-known news magazine program. And we showed some of the photos in that, but he got off on a technicality because he knew the judge. He actually knew the USDA inspector who claimed he had been out there. And 6 weeks later, the sheriffs were called out, and there's decomposing bodies and skeletal remains, and dogs had starved to death. So I don't think the USDA inspector had ever gone out there because I think he knew the breeder. But, typically, the conditions we see are, algae in the water, dirty food bowls, no food, no water, fecal accumulation, rusty wire, dogs having to... Now, the wire is supposed to be plastic-coated now. Sometimes it isn't. Sharp edges. Dogs just, not getting veterinary care, being sick. I mean, we've seen some... We are at a facility that we've been investigating for a long time that is no longer federally licensed. It's just state licensed, which means it's no longer selling to pet shops, selling to the public. But there was a Chihuahua puppy there dying and going into seizures and gasping for air. And the woman came out and she said, "Oh, well, puppies die." And we went to the authorities. Now, here's what's interesting. The veterinarian for this breeder happens to be the animal control director, so that's a conflict of interest right there. Mm-hmm. Animal control wouldn't do anything, and they called the state inspector, and the state inspector, of course, doesn't like us, so he told them not to do anything. And then we went to the state's attorney, which is the prosecutor for that area, and he doesn't like us either because of an earlier incident with this particular breeder. The breeder actually was beating a dog that we were rescuing from him, and the prosecutor refused to bring charges. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if anything was ever done about this puppy or not. I mean, we tried to report it, and the authorities wouldn't cooperate.
Good grief.
And the state's attorney wouldn't give me any information because he said, "Well, last time I spoke to you, I didn't realize I was on the record." And I said, "I'm not a reporter. You weren't on the record." But I didn't get any cooperation, so I wrote an article about it.
Yeah,
and it went up on our website. That's the kind of thing where, there's another case, a horrific puppy mill. We finally got the guy convicted of neglect, but it took us 3 years. The sheriffs and the prosecutor didn't do anything with our evidence the first time around, and we went back and we kept after them, and it was a man who had dropped his USDA license but was still selling to a broker. USDA wouldn't do anything about it. There were dead dogs there. We rescued some dogs from there that were in really bad shape. And it was just one of the dirtiest places I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But it took us 3 years to finally get him prosecuted.
Oh, dear.
So it's really, really hard to get these places, prosecuted too.
Yeah, yeah. You've painted a very bleak and a very moving picture there.
Right.
One of the things I do believe in is when we give people information, we empower them. And if you give people the chance, and, if you give dog lovers the chance, they can work together, and really help. So how can people help you and CAPS?
Okay, well, the first thing people can do is just do not buy a dog from a pet shop. I can't stress that enough, that is not where you go to get a dog.
Mm.
And like I said, try to adopt from a shelter, try to adopt from a rescue organization. Sometimes veterinarians have unwanted animals. I mean, there's so many animals that need homes, and, rescue animals, they really know you've done something special for them.
Mm.
All my dogs are rescue animals, and they're very, very devoted, to you. I have all kinds of rescue animals here. I have one that we rescued, our investigators rescued from South Dakota from a puppy mill, and she's 4 years old, and she's already blind in one eye from glaucoma, and we're trying to save the other eye. She's had thousands of dollars in eye surgeries, and she also has deformed elbows. She had mycoplasma pneumonia when we first got her. She had infected ears. She had mange, and she was going to be breeding stock at a puppy mill. But they gave her to us because she had the deformed elbows, and then the breeder said, "Well, you can have the mother and the grandmother too." So we got three Basset hounds that way.
Mm-hmm.
I have another dog that's off the streets of Puerto Rico who's dying on the street. She's our advice columnist, Carmen, and the other two are just one my friend rescued, another one I've got from a rescue organization. But yeah, rescue dogs, they know that you've made a difference in their life, and it's very rewarding. And people shouldn't give up on an animal, you know, a shelter animal. Sometimes they might take a little more work, a little more obedience, but ultimately, the reward, you know, is really worth it. The other thing people can do, you know, to help us is go to pet shops and find out where the puppies are coming from. We're always looking for breeder names, for broker names. They can report that to us through our, we have a, you know, pet shop complaint form. They can educate others. We have literature that you can download from our website, fact sheets. We can send them brochures. We can send them newsletters and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And give us the address of the website, Deborah, please.
Yes, www.capcaps-web.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and presumably there's tons of information there and help for people.
Yeah, there's a lot of information, and in fact, we're also putting together a website specifically for teens and college age students, which doesn't have a URL yet, but the focus of that is going to be on educating that age group before they become old enough to become pet shop purchasers.
Yeah. Definitely.
And also to encourage those who are already informed and educated on how to be activists with this issue.
Yeah, yeah. I think that what you've said is absolutely right. Think of your dog, you know, your dog that you love.
Exactly.
And how you would want him or her to be treated. And there are thousands of dogs that are not getting that treatment, that are getting far from that. You know, you would want
exactly.
to help them. Yeah, yeah.
Right, right. These are just dogs that live their entire lives in confinement and are just bred all the time until, I mean, a lot of times the dogs are destroyed if they're not producing large enough litters. And they're, you know, or they're given away or, you know, that we've rescued a number of dogs. And oftentimes we get the used up breeding stock or we get the dogs that were sick and returned from a pet shop.
Yeah.
So we get a lot of these dogs and we place them in homes. But the one, it's really pathetic. I mean, the ones that have lived in puppy mills for 10 years are usually so sick, especially the female dogs that have just had litter after litter after
yeah.
litter. I mean, if you're 10 years old and you've been in heat twice a year, I mean, you probably
oh, yeah.
had, 20 litters of puppies almost.
Yeah.
So we've seen all kinds of, you know medical problems as a result of this, and from poor diet and stress and so forth, too.
Yeah.
Really very, very hard on these dogs. And a lot of them are living with inadequate shelter, too, and they live in cold climates. I mean, there are, of course, regulations for all of this, but like I said, you know, they're not strictly enforced by our government.
Mm. And, I mean, do you have any letters or anything that people can send to their, I don't know the term in America, but their congressman or their, you know, their...
Well, if you go on our website, you can read about what the government, you know, about the United States Department of Agriculture, and we have where you can write letters to, and you know, we're trying to get congressional oversight hearings, and so people can, you know, contact us for more information about which, you know, you have to find out if your congressman is on these particular committees or just write, you can just write to your congressman or write to your senator and express concern about this issue. We're trying also to get what's called a government accountability office investigation. That's the audit arm of the Congress, and they can do an investigation and an audit of the United States Department of Agriculture's inspection program. And the only time that one of these investigations was done was in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at the inspection program, so it's been 22 years, and that was the only time it was done. To get one of those investigations started, it only takes one senator requesting it, and the more senators or congressmen that request it, the faster it would happen. But so far we haven't had any, even though we've drafted a letter and given it to members of Congress to submit, nobody's done that so far.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's you know, it's very, going to Washington is an interesting experience. It also can be kind of a frustrating one as well.
If you would like to ease the frustration and improve or save the lives of dogs caught up in the pet store and puppy mill nightmare, check out the CAPS website. Deborah, I wish you lots of luck and success with the fight. Basset hounds have great difficulty swimming. because their bodies are too heavy for their short legs to keep afloat. Now we hear Bernard Cartwright read another extract from his book, The Knocknobbler, which details his time working as a dog warden in Worcester in the UK.
This is the story of Polly Sevenlegs. Roaming is a curious thing. From culvert to copse, from lane to street, the straying dog goes sniffing for something familiar along the way. For some inexplicable reason to the stray dog mind, many doormats have the word welcome written on them, which in reality proves not to be the case. This paradox is further compounded when, in an aggressive manner, a human appears and gives our dog that symbol of loyalty and service, the new name of Shoo. My last job today, before darkness, was to respond to a call from Shrub Hill Railway Station to pick up a friendly wire-haired terrier called Dash, belonging to Jim and Susie Rushuck, who lived in an unpretentious house near Shrub Hill. This white dog looked like Snowy from the Tintin cartoon books. Upon returning the stray, which spiralled with delight when released from Pix's cage — Pix is my dog van, by the way, I call it Pix because I pick dogs up — I was invited into this house for a cup of tea, while Jim, the dog owner, wrote out a cheque for the stray dog fine. He told me he was a soft tissue salesman and was away a lot, like his daughter, who lived in London. Susie, his wife, said too that she worked irregular hours as a care assistant and wasn't really giving Dash all the attention he deserved. I noticed that stuck on their fridge, with some gaffer tape, was a dog-eared cutting from the London Evening Standard, containing a picture of a ballerina. "That's our Polly," said Jim. "She's a dancer." The photograph was taken when we won our tussle over the grant to send her to dance school. We lived up in North Staffordshire then. I nodded in admiration, left my cup of tea half finished, advising the family to get the terrier tagged. 6 weeks later, I picked up Dash from Lower's Moor this time, and even though he had no tag or microchip, I recognised him immediately. Again, out came Rushuck's checkbook. This happened, I suppose, about 3 times more over that spring and summer, so in the end I felt I had to waive the fine. I saw Polly at home on one occasion. She told me her parents tried to wire up the hedges, but they couldn't keep the dog in the garden, as it nearly always dug itself out. "We used to live on a farm near Stone, so Dash had to the run of the place," explained Polly. So I mentioned to her that if the dog had a chip in its neck or an ID disc, I'd return it to the family free of charge, as part of the council service. "I've taken nearly £300 from your mother and father, and I could have taken more, all for the sake of a collar tag, costing £3. She said she'd see what she could do. It was late on the following year when I was called to Shrub Hill Station again, and there was Dash sitting on the platform edge. When I mentioned his name, he came away with me easily. I walked round to Rushuck's home and waited for one of them to come back from work. It so happened they came back together, and as always were relieved to see their pet once more. Without me saying anything, Jim said — he was on the platform at the station, wasn't he? "Well, yes, he was," I replied. Jim spoke slowly. "He's waiting for Polly, you see, to come off the Paddington train. We always went across to the station to pick her up, but there's not so much of that now. Do come in, Mr. Cartwright." "Susie, I'm putting the kettle on," he said. As we drank tea together in their tiny kitchen, Jim said between gulps and long pauses, Polly, she had a bit of trouble with the theatre, you know. And not the actual place, you understand, but a certain person. She had a crush on a man 15 years her senior. He didn't see it in the same way. Went on for about a year, I suppose. Her performances were ravishing. Anyway, it was obsessively compulsive behaviour, I guess, but who am I to denigrate her? Susie then chipped in. Polly didn't have the swan neck grace of a prima ballerina, and she had short, fast legs, you know, like that football chappie Michael Owen. Her nickname in the company was Polly Seven Legs. It's all beauty and box office now, isn't it? Frustration can lead to anything. One night after the performance, but after the punters had left, Polly threw herself out of a window and was only saved by a flagpole and some awning. She had a fractured pelvis and, oh, the bruising. She'll never dance again at that level, poor fool. Jim concluded. Being a trained person, Polly was naturally resilient and so pulled through quickly. And the dance company were very good about it all. They pulled strings to get her assessed at Oswestry, as Os was more convenient for us than the hospital of Stoke Mandeville, being as I work north of here. Polly's just stopped walking with a stick now and barely refers to the incident. The fellow went to work in broadcasting, I think, and Polly started in theatre administration in the West End and has met someone nice from there. So she doesn't come home that much. She works in the box office too. So all this is why, if we're not at home, Dash roams across the Shrub Hill station as devoted as ever and just sits there waiting for her to come back.
A bloodhound called Tigger holds the record for the longest ears on a dog, having a right ear of 13.75 inches and a left ear of 13.5 inches long. That's it for this episode. So till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315 849 2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121 288 0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What's the difference between dogs and fleas? A dog can have fleas, but a flea can't have dogs.